All right, let's get started. Ring the bell. Welcome to The Music Never Stopped, and this is a panel specifically about the sounding notes, I think. We have Jake and Eric and myself, and I think we're going Jake first. Is that what we decided?
Eric first. Me first.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, most of you know Eric. This is his bio. Eric teaches English and sociology at Northtown Academy College Prep in Chicago. He saw The Grateful Dead over 60 times and has been presenting at this conference for the last 6 years. Today he'll discuss how the Rolling Stones were in fact a huge, though rarely acknowledged, influence on The Grateful Dead. Please welcome Eric.
Thank you, Sean. First, just want to say I talk about a lot of songs in this, and I have all the ones that I talk about I have on a CD with me. I'm only going to play a couple of them during the presentation, but if there's time and interest later, I'll be happy to play some of the others. So if I mention it in the paper, you can hear it. Okay. When in doubt, open with a Jerry Garcia quote. Here's mine. And most of you probably will know we have Mr. Gans to thank for this. I never liked the Doors. I found them terribly offensive when we played with them. It was back when Jim Morrison was just a pure Mick Jagger copy. That was his whole shot, that he was a Mick Jagger imitation. Not vocally, but his moves, his whole physical appearance were stolen from right around Mick Jagger's 1965 tour of the States. He was so patently an imitation of Mick Jagger that it was offensive. Hidden beneath Jerry's mean-spirited, and I would argue inaccurate, portrayal of the Doors, a band I happen to love, is an unstated reverence for the Rolling Stones. Jerry wouldn't have been so offended by Jim Morrison's whole physical appearance if he didn't have a deep-rooted love and respect for Mick Jagger and the Stones. But did that love and respect reveal itself in Garcia's music? I think so, though it requires a little digging to figure out exactly how. That the Rolling Stones were an influence on the Grateful Dead is rarely disputed. It was virtually impossible to be an American rock and roll band, circa 1965 to 1967, without incorporating the Rolling Stones sound in some way. All of the British invasion bands had a huge impact on the American rock and roll scene at the time, but the Stones, even more than the Beatles, impacted what since come to be known as the garage band sound of the mid-60s, a sound the early Grateful Dead certainly embraced and embodied. One obvious reason for this influence was the Stones' incorporation of American blues music, a genre that the Beatles, for all their talent and influence, never really explored. But how deeply did the Stones' influence manifest itself in the Grateful Dead's music? It is believed that the Warlocks performed both The Last Time and Satisfaction, though no recordings are known to exist, but that's not saying much. Kids wanted to hear the latest hits when they went out to see a dance band in 1965. They didn't care who was playing it. If you wanted to be a popular live band that year, you'd better have been playing Satisfaction. Significantly, the Dead brought that particular anthem back into occasional rotation as late as 1980 and revived The Last Time a decade later. But what's more revealing is the 1966 studio recording of the relatively obscure Rolling Stones original, Empty Heart, that turned up on the Grateful Dead's unimaginatively titled 2005 collection, Rare Cuts and Oddities. Not every band in the mid-60s covered or even knew that song. So I agree with David Gans, who last year at this conference quipped, "The Dead started out as a Rolling Stones cover band." But it's important to point out that as the Grateful Dead's career progressed, for the most part it wasn't the Dead covering Stones originals so much as the Dead covering Stones covers. And that's where things get interesting. All these years later, it's impossible to guess how familiar the members of the Grateful Dead may have been with the Rolling Stones sources. Pigpen, Jerry, and even Bobby were all walking music encyclopedias. So, for instance, it's a safe bet that Weir knew he was performing a song by Al Green, not one by Talking Heads, when he introduced Take Me to the River as a solo artist in 1991 and with the Grateful Dead in 1995. On the other hand, as recently as 2005, Mickey Hart said that the Dead learned Good Lovin' from the Rascals, implying that he at least was unfamiliar with the antecedent by the Olympics, and probably very few people outside of this room know that a certain Lemmy Be Good made an even earlier recording of the song. But what about all those Rolling Stones songs? How do they fit into this discussion? The Grateful Dead surely knew that Chuck Berry wrote and recorded Around and Around in 1958. The Stones recorded the song in 1964, and the Dead started performing it in 1970. Did the Chuck Berry original inspire them, or was it the Rolling Stones cover version? On the other hand, not many people know that It's All Over Now was originally recorded by Bobby Womack's first group, The Valentinos, in March 1964. The Stones covered the song less than 3 months later and made it famous. The Dead performed the song as early as 1969, and it became a regular part of their repertoire by 1976. But where did they learn it? From Womack or the Stones? Being such thorough blues enthusiasts, it's a guarantee that the Dead were familiar with Howlin' Wolf's original 1961 recording of Willie Dixon's The Red Rooster by the time they began performing the song in 1980. But they were certainly familiar with the Rolling Stones' 1965 cover, one of the first to add Little to the title, as well. Could that have been the Dead's inspiration as much as or more than the original? Likewise, when the Dead recorded Walking the Dog in 1966, did they learn it from Rufus Thomas's 1963 original or the Stones' 1964 cover? And again, the Dead must have known both Sam Cooke's original 1964 rendition of Good Times and the Stones' 1965 reading of the song. Would the Dead have done the song, which they introduced as late as 1988, if the Stones hadn't done it too? In short, were both bands drawing from the same sources, or did the Grateful Dead learn these songs from the Rolling Stones? These questions are difficult to answer, and pinpointing evidence of where the Dead learned their cover songs and why they decided to add them to the repertoire requires a considerable amount of conjecture. But one song just might provide a key to the puzzle. The members of the Grateful Dead were obviously familiar with Buddy Holly, though they probably didn't know that Oh Boy, which the Dead covered twice, began life as All of My Love by Holly's fellow Texan Sonny West. West did the original Ray Vaughan too, by the way. But were the Dead familiar with Holly's 1957 original version of Not Fade Away when they began performing the song in 1968? Not Fade Away began life as the relatively obscure B-side to Oh Boy. It certainly was never the household name that Holly songs like That'll Be the Day and Peggy Sue are to this day. So where did the Grateful Dead learn it? In the most direct terms, how do we get from this to this. Those opening power chords come from? They're nowhere in Holly's original, but they were a part of the Dead's rendition throughout their career. Pure Dead invention, or were those opening chords borrowed from somewhere else? The answer lies here. Now let's revisit Little Red Rooster. Here's the opening of the Grateful Dead's version from Dead Set. Too late. Now listen to Howlin' Wolf's original. Finally, the Stones cover.
I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day.
Dead's arrangement is clearly patterned after the Stones, and as you can hear, the slide guitar, while present in Howlin' Wolf's version, is much more prominent in the Stones and later the Dead's interpretations. But it's not just the music that's more similar. Note how the Stones change Wolf's lyric, "I have a little red rooster," to "I am the little red rooster," a variation the Dead adopted in a song that wasn't introduced until 1980. The sheer volume of cover songs the Grateful Dead performed that the Rolling Stones covered first, 11 in all, perhaps provides the most evidence of the Stones' influence on the Dead. And if we expand the list to include Stones' originals that the Dead covered, and both Stones' covers and originals that made it into Garcia's and Weir's solo repertoires, the number stretches to 20. That's a hefty chunk of the catalog. All told, there are more Stone songs than anyone else's after Bob Dylan's in the entire non-original Grateful Dead canon. Because these are mostly covers of covers, no one put it together before. But from the perspective of which material the Grateful Dead chose to perform throughout their career, the Rolling Stones' influence on the Grateful Dead is overwhelming. I chose this topic because I discovered it quite by accident. I always thought it was fun if I saw the Grateful Dead encore with satisfaction, but I didn't think much more of it. Truth be told, the idea for this paper came when I first heard the Rolling Stones' recording of Not Fade Away. The Grateful Dead's was the first version I had ever heard of Not Fade Away. It was thrilling to finally hear Buddy Holly's original version, which I discovered on The Music Never Stopped. But later, when I heard the opening chords of the Rolling Stones version and realized that it was clearly the Stones, more than Buddy Holly himself, who inspired the Dead's version of that particular song, a light bulb went off in my head. I quickly bought the remainder of the Rolling Stones' early albums, and the rest all fell into place. We are all, of course, familiar with the legendary variety of musical backgrounds of the members of the Grateful Dead. I even mentioned the subject in my paper last year. But for all the talk about Jerry being a bluegrass lover, Bobby the folky, Pigpen the blues enthusiast, Bill the jazz drummer, and Phil the classically trained one who could play violin and trumpet, there's rarely mention of how the Grateful Dead were inspired by good old rock and roll itself. It was Chuck Berry who motivated a teenage Jerry Garcia to pick up the guitar, and a Berry number even made it into the repertoire of the utterly unrock-like pre-Dead ensemble Mother McCree's Uptown Jug Champions. The Beatles may have been the spark that gave the early 60s folk revivalists the consent to go electric, and we've all heard the stories of how Seeing a Hard Day's Night inspired Phil and Jerry to embrace rock and roll. But it was the Rolling Stones that made electric blues acceptable and respectable for the emerging rock groups on this side of the pond. The Beatles played concerts for the Queen and covered songs like Till There Was You, not so the Rolling Stones. It was the Stones that gave permission for rock and roll to be dirty, nasty, even sexy if it wanted. So it wasn't just music the Grateful Dead and the other garage bands of the mid-60s learned from the Stones, it was attitude. And that's why Jerry's quote about Jim Morrison bothers me. I imagine it wasn't really Morrison's appropriation of Mick Jagger's style that Jerry found terribly offensive, so much as resentment over other musicians borrowing from the Stones as much as he himself was. Musicians have always sponged off one another, some just did it more subtly than others. We should definitely be thankful that the Grateful Dead incorporated such diverse musical styles. To this day, there aren't many concerts where you're likely to hear songs by Bob Dylan, Miles Davis, Chuck Berry, Bob Marley, the Carter Family, Reverend Gary Davis, Marvin Gaye, Merle Haggard, Warren Zevon, and something as experimental as Space, all performed by the same band, possibly at the same concert. That eclectic mix certainly was part of the magic that helps explain why we're all here at this conference. But the Grateful Dead were always a rock and roll band first and foremost, and for that we have the Rolling Stones, more than anyone else, to thank.